We are currently $27,000 short of budget after the first 7 months of this year. Please consider making a special summer contribution to support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. You can make a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. You can also make a financial gift by check. Make your check payable to Issues Etc. Send it to Issues Etc., Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks for listening, and thanks for keeping us in mind during the difficult summer months. Probably next to Moses, he stands out in his day as the biggest figure. He, in fact, succeeds Moses in his prophetic ministry, also in leadership of the people of Israel as they enter the land, they conquer the land. They take this land, and then they allot it for themselves. But Joshua's entire ministry, if you want to call it that, has standing behind it a greater Joshua. In fact, he appears there very early in the book of Joshua. Even before it is time to conquer the land, he is, in effect, the general of the Lord's armies. Now, he's not given a name. He's just called the general of the Lord's armies. He appears there to Joshua before they go into battle. And Joshua worships him. On his knees, he worships him. This is the greater Joshua. This is the one who is yet to come, the one who appears there to Joshua and will later not only appear, but will become incarnate in human flesh. What does it mean that Jesus is there in the Old Testament? Through the ministry of Joshua, actually leading God's people into this land for a real military conquest. That's not a picture we have of Jesus in our mind very often, but what does it mean? And where is Jesus going with this? Is it just about the physical land? Is it just about conquering this little piece of real estate over there in what we call today the Middle East? Joining us to talk about the Old Testament figure Joshua, Dr. Andrew Steinman. He's Distinguished Professor of Theology and Hebrew at Concordia University, Chicago, and he's author of the book From Abraham to Paul, A Biblical Chronology. Dr. Steinman, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Good to be with you, Todd.
Of course, there is a book that's called Joshua that largely deals with his time as judge over Israel after Moses, but we hear about Joshua as a younger man in the book of Exodus. And when we're reading these kind of occasional mentions of him, are we kind of being set up as the reader of the book of Exodus for the fact that Joshua is going to eventually succeed none other than Moses himself?
Yes, there are a couple indications of that. Already in the book of Exodus, the first time we meet him, he's appointed a kind of commander of the army that has to go out and fight the Amalekites, these people that oppose Israel when they come up out of Egypt. And so we can see here already that it's recognized he has certain leadership qualities. Obviously, since he's chosen, he is obviously somebody that Moses trusts, and by extension, therefore, we have to assume God trusts, since Moses usually consults God in all these things. We meet him again in Exodus when we're told he's Moses' assistant in chapter 24, we meet him again in the Pentateuch when he's one of the spies that are sent out to spy the land, and of course he's one of the two faithful spies who urges the people go up and take the land, not the ten who say we can't do this. So we get a picture of Joshua as somebody who was recognized early on after the Exodus as a leader among God's people, and somebody who therefore is chosen to work closely with Moses. It's kind of an apprenticeship. So it's not surprising, then, that when we get to the end of the Pentateuch in Deuteronomy, that the leadership is handed over to Joshua, and then he takes over in the book of Joshua.
Now, he's unique even over against Moses in that he is someone who is around before the generation that essentially rebels. And then that generation is allowed to die off, more or less, 40 years in the wilderness. But Joshua survives that. And even over against Moses, who doesn't enter the promised land, he does. Joshua seems to be among the very few, if I don't know, maybe could we say the only person who came out of Egypt and ended up in the Promised Land?
He's one of two.
Really?
Yes. The other one is Caleb, the other faithful spy. And Caleb and Joshua are the only two adults who come out of Egypt and go into the Promised Land. There may have been some children, because God said that during those 40 years that they were going to wander in the wilderness, that all the adults would die, and he would take the next generation, the children, and of course those born during the 40 years, into the land. And the only exceptions are these two spies, Joshua and Caleb. You know, and as you're following the story along, you're right to compare him to Moses, because it looks like, well, Moses is going to be one of the people too, because he didn't rebel. But of course, he does kind of rebel against God later on, when he doesn't follow God's instructions carefully with the incident of bringing water from the rock. And so that's why Moses is disqualified, kind of a bittersweet story at the end of Moses' life. But nevertheless, Joshua seems to be the one that, along with Caleb, remains faithful to God throughout these 40 years from beginning to end.
Does that also explain why, through Joshua, God is so intent upon when the people enter that land, even before they begin the conquest, so to speak, reminding these people in no uncertain terms as to what he has done for them in the last two generations?
Yeah, and it makes it clear. I think one of the fascinating things about the end of Deuteronomy and going into the beginning of Joshua, it makes it clear that this is all God's plan, that God has chosen Joshua. It's not an accident that Joshua became Moses' assistant. God has chosen Joshua. He's equipped Joshua for this. And the end of Deuteronomy, the beginning of Joshua, emphasizes this, and I think this is very important for the people of Israel, and something that we, you know, living in modern Western countries don't get, because we're used to, you know, the president's around for 4 or 8 years, and then we get another one. Or, you know, if you live in Great Britain, the prime minister might last 10 years at most, but, you know, but sooner or later you're going to get another one, and et cetera. But Moses is the leader for 40 years. And the people have to be thinking, okay, what's going on here? This next guy that takes over, is he going to be as good? Can we trust him? Can we have confidence in him? And I think the emphasis at the end of Deuteronomy and the beginning of Joshua is, it's not really about Moses or Joshua leading the people. It's ultimately about God leading the people. Moses and Joshua are simply the servants through whom God works. And so this emphasis that we have, that Joshua is the one whom God chose and through whom God works and whom God has enabled to be faithful during this whole time, gives the people confidence then when Moses dies that Joshua can indeed do the job.
Then let's deal with one detail as to Joshua that perhaps casts his entire ministry, before we get into those other details, in a different light. Is the coincidence between his name and the other Joshuas in Scripture, namely the one that will come that we usually refer to as Jesus, is that mere coincidence?
I think not. I think this is somewhat prophetic on Moses' part, because his name isn't Joshua when he's born. We're told in the book of Numbers that Moses renamed Hosea Joshua. Now, that's an interesting little change, because Hosea means something like he saves, with the he not very specific. But Joshua means Yahweh saves, the Lord saves. And I think it points forward to Jesus. And so I think that by the mere act of renaming Joshua, Moses is pointing forward to a greater leader of God's people who will come. And that is, of course, Jesus, who shares the same name. You're right. Many people don't realize this, but the name Joshua has, you know, several forms depending on what language you're talking about. So Yehoshua, which gives us Joshua in English, is the Hebrew form. There's an Aramaic form, Yeshua, which sometimes people use for Jesus' name too. But there's a man named Yeshua in the book of Nehemiah. That's the Aramaic form. And then when it was taken over into Greek, it becomes Jesus. And in fact, if you read the ancient Greek translation of the Bible, that's how Joshua is called. He's called Jesus back there. Jesus. And that we get that Jesus basically from the Greek version of this name. And so Jesus shares the same name with this man. And I don't think that's by accident. I think Moses naming Joshua is actually a prophetic act.
If a secular historian were going to go back and research the life of Joshua from his first appearance there in Exodus all the way through the book that bears his name, would it be safe to say that that historian might record his life or treat his life something like that of, say, Alexander the Great, a military leader rather than kind of a spiritual leader? What are your thoughts there?
Yeah, I think they probably would. There's a tendency, I think, especially for somebody that has great military victories, to kind of concentrate on that when writing history, and not concentrate on the other aspects of their life necessarily. And so I think that probably would be the case. But I think the interesting thing is that the Bible doesn't concentrate so much on Joshua's military successes. And obviously there's a lot of on that in the book of Joshua. But even in the book of Joshua, towards the end, Joshua is not the military leader, but he's the spiritual leader. And this is emphasized very much at the end of the book of Joshua, as well as some of these passages earlier on where Joshua is faithful to the Lord.
Dr. Andrew Steinman is our guest. We're talking about Old Testament Judge Joshua on this Friday afternoon, August the 30th. Stay tuned. More Issues, Etc. after this.
The Lord has gifts of forgiveness, life, and salvation. These gifts can be received every week at both Grace Lutheran Church and Trinity Lutheran Church in Wichita, Kansas. Join us for divine services at Grace on Sundays at 8 a.m. and 4:30 p.m., as well as every Wednesday at 11 a.m., or at Trinity every Sunday at 11 a.m. Grace is located at 3310 East Pawnee and Trinity at 611 South Erie. Gather with us around our Lord and His giving His gifts to us. See you soon.
The theme of the Scriptures is the promise of Christ and the coming of Christ and the meaning of that. And you can lose that in pietism.
Dr. Rod Rosenblatt, co-host of the White Horse Inn radio show, speaking at the Issues, Etc. Making the Case conference.
The common emphasis is the emphasis on sanctification. Sounds good, biblical, it is. But you get the emphasis on the wrong syllable, and we'll lose our own children.
You can listen to Dr. Rosenblatt's presentation, Making the Case Against Pietism, and all of our presentations from this year's conference on our new audio DVD. For a donation of $300 to Issues, Etc. before Labor Day, we'll send you this audio DVD. For more information, look for the DVD logo on our homepage, issuesetc.org.
What happens when you take solid doctrine and solid curriculum and combine them with ancient scholars and modern technology? You get Wittenberg Academy, the very first completely online classical Lutheran high school. We are unabashedly Lutheran and offer families a rigorous standard of academic excellence. Students can pick and choose classes, or they can utilize our entire curriculum for their high school education. Visit our website, WittenbergAcademy.org, to find out more.
Grace, faith, Scripture, and Christ alone. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, Executive Director of Life Issues Institute.
Would abortion be the answer if a woman knew her unborn baby would contract a disease and spend his entire life hooked up to a respirator in a hospital? Sadly, it would be for most American women. Planned Parenthood and many doctors would say it'd be cruel to bring such a child into the world, but that's exactly the situation for Paulo Machado in Brazil. He and other children who contracted polio were given a life expectancy of only 10 years. Paulo, who's 45 years old, is happy and content with his life. He raised money online so he can computer animate a book written by a fellow patient about the lives of children on their ward. Aborting any baby is telling God he doesn't know what he's doing, and man just can't win that debate.
For more information, visit our website at lifeissues.org and stay informed. More informed than you've ever been.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. On this Friday afternoon, August the 30th, we're talking about Joshua with Dr. Andrew Steinman. Before the break, Dr. Steinman, you pointed out that we really should note that Joshua is both military leader, no doubt about that, but also definitely spiritual leader, especially toward the end of the book that bears his name. But let's stay on the subject of war a little bit more. How does war fit into God's plan for his people at this point in their history? How does God want the Israelites to understand, to view their military exploits?
Well, already God prophesied to Abraham that when he brought the people back out of Egypt, he told Abraham, your people are going to go down to Egypt, they're going to be there 400 years, I'm going to bring them out. And why are they there 400 years? So that the sins of the Canaanites might be filled up before I bring the people into the land. So one of the functions, clearly, that the Bible says for Israel fighting these wars is actually to visit God's punishment on them for their sins. And if you've studied the Canaanite religion and practices, there were some very horrific practices, including but not limited to child sacrifice. So God is rightly disgusted with some of these practices, and Israel becomes his instrument for meting out punishment for those practices. Now, this doesn't make Israel necessarily unique in the Old Testament, because we know, of course, later on that God uses the Assyrians and the Babylonians as his instruments to punish other people, such as Israel itself. So God can use a nation for that. But he's also accomplishing a second purpose with this conquest and the military action, and that is to fulfill his promise to Abraham that he would bring his people back to the land of Canaan and give it to them as their homeland, their possession granted by God. So there are a couple things going on here, and the Bible doesn't shy away from the fact that God can use nations and military actions at times to mete out punishment. We need to be careful, of course, of identifying modern military actions with things like that, because we don't always know how God is working through modern military actions. He hasn't revealed that to us. But in the case of Israel, he actually revealed that to us, so we can make a statement like that.
Before, kind of connected to that, before their first big conquest, which is an odd one in itself, the fall of Jericho, probably the strongest and most proximate city of the land to their entrance, Joshua sees the commander of the Lord's armies. This is in chapter 5, right there in the middle. Who is this?
This most clearly is Jesus before his incarnation. This person that appears to Joshua is first of all called the commander of the Lord's army, starting in about verse 13, where he appears to Joshua. But then he's still around at the beginning of chapter 6 when we're told Jericho was shut up and nobody went in and out. And then in verse 2 it says, and the Lord said to Joshua, and I believe this is a continuation of this conversation with this commander of the Lord's army. The commander of the Lord's army is the Lord. And then, in fact, it is Jesus. And in fact, this I think is also the person who's referred to elsewhere in the Old Testament as the angel or messenger of the Lord, because God said specifically through Moses that he would send his angel ahead of the people, the angel of the Lord ahead of the people as they come into the land. And so when Joshua meets this person, this commander of the Lord's army, or elsewhere called the angel of the Lord, he's meeting the pre-incarnate Christ, the second person of the Trinity, who is leading his people into the promised land. And this is a foretaste of Jesus, of course, leading us into the land that he has promised us, the new heavens and the new earth in the final resurrection.
Oh, is this an indication that for all that Joshua will do, as able as he is as leader, judge, military general, he's not really the commander at all?
Yeah, and Joshua understands this, I think, pretty well most of the time. There is one incident, perhaps, where he gets a little ahead of himself with the Gibeonites, but other than that, Joshua pretty much understands that what he is doing, he's doing simply as an instrument of God's choosing, that it's God who gives the victory. And so we have this rather well-known incident where Joshua, you know, appeals to the sun to stand still in the sky to give them extra time to defeat their enemies. Well, of course, this basically is Joshua relying on God's power to change the way the universe works, something that Joshua himself can't do. And so that in itself, I think, is an indication that Joshua is relying on God for the victory, and that he might be the kind of the human commander who organizes the army on the ground, but God is really the commander, and ultimately God is the one who fights for Israel.
Are the first two campaigns, so to speak, the first one Jericho, the second one Ai, that another strong city, are they put together as contrasts with one another about how Israel is to conduct itself in the land?
Well, most definitely Ai follows Jericho to make that contrast. And the writer of Joshua, I think, purposely highlights the contrast between these two. Not that they didn't happen together. I think they did happen right after one another. But I think the way he writes it, he purposely draws a contrast. Joshua's and the Israelites are faithful in doing everything God commanded them when they conquered Jericho, except for, of course, Achan. Achan disobeys, and they were supposed to take all the spoil from the city of Jericho and dedicate it to God. God claimed it because he's the one who ultimately gave Israel the victory. And this was making that point kind of what an exclamation point. Since God won the victory, he gets all the spoils. And so that's what they were supposed to do. But Achan takes a few items, buries them in his tent, and then when they go up to Ai to conquer it, they're defeated, and they come back and ask God why, and then God reveals to them that it was Achan who had done this. And so because of this one incident among the troops where someone was not faithful, God clearly makes the point, you know, that he is the one who fights, and this contrast between Israel not dedicating to God everything, because after all it was God who gave the victory, it was God who knocked the walls down, that is not acceptable. They need to keep reminding themselves that victory comes from the Lord.
Is there also something there, and also in the rest of the book of Joshua, about the way the war is conducted, the dedication of spoils, things like that, wherein God is protecting his people from the inevitable temptation toward idolatry?
Yeah, he's doing this all along. He makes sure, you know, that they are not to take certain spoils ever. Some said he does allow them to take spoils, but certain spoils they're never to take. And he makes it clear over and over again that, you know, he is the only God. which therefore makes him superior to the other gods. And this is why they can have victory. The other gods are nothing. And therefore, this is why they can have victory. And so he keeps on kind of trying to pound this point home. And when they simply don't trust God or don't consult God before what they do, they get in trouble. This happens with this incident I mentioned earlier with the Gibeonites. The Gibeonites come to Israel. They had put on old, worn clothes and got old provisions and came and said, "We came from a land far away. You know, make a treaty with us." Well, this was a ruse. They were in the land of Canaan. They didn't want to be wiped out as the other Canaanites. And this is the one incident where Joshua doesn't consult God before he makes this pledge to them, this treaty with them, that they will not be destroyed. And so, you know, this one incident causes some problems. The Gibeonites are eventually punished for their complicity in all of this, but nevertheless, it is kind of a one blot on Joshua that he doesn't stop and consult God at that point before making this treaty. Had they actually been from outside the land of Israel, there was nothing that said that Israel couldn't, have some type of friendship with them. But they were not to spare the people of the land. And so God makes a point again. You know, I'm in charge. You need to consult me because I'm the one who actually is doing the fighting. No matter what your eyes see, your eyes may see, you know, your soldiers out there swinging their swords or slinging their sling stones, but I'm the one who's actually fighting.
We're talking about Joshua on this Friday afternoon, August the 30th. The church remembers Joshua on the 1st of September. Dr. Andrew Steinman is our guest, distinguished professor of theology and Hebrew at Concordia University, Chicago, author of the book From Abraham to Paul, A Biblical Chronology. When we come back, in chapter 12 of Joshua, there's kind of a roll call. Everybody stops for a while, and they even allot the land to every tribe and a few individuals. Is this the stopping point? Why is there some land left unconquered? We'll answer that question after this. Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Christ Lutheran, Jackson, Mississippi. Prince of Peace Lutheran, San Diego, California. Trinity Lutheran, Tryon, North Carolina. Our Redeemer Lutheran, Dallas, Texas, Calvary Lutheran, Yuma, Arizona, St. Paul Lutheran, Milford Center, Ohio, Peace Lutheran, Chehalis, Washington, Christ Lutheran, Noblesville, Indiana, Our Redeemer Lutheran, Lexington, Kentucky, and St. James Lutheran, Baltimore, Maryland. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, click support, and print the one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll publicize your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. issuesetc.org, click support, the Issues Etc. 300.
Real Reformation Radio, you're listening to Issues Etc.
The 500th anniversary of the Lutheran Reformation is fast approaching. We have such a rich history as Lutherans, and many people don't realize that. The CLCC offers a seminar called Your Reformation Walk that teaches that rich heritage and helps you appreciate it. The CLCC also offers other seminars designed to help laity learn to appreciate what Lutherans believe, teach, and confess. So invite us to your church. Visit theclcc.org and get details on scheduling a seminar for your church today.
No gimmicks, no shticks, just straightforward preaching and teaching in accord with Scripture and the Lutheran confessions. By the book liturgy, right from the hymnal. No glitz, just Christ crucified for sinners like us. We're Grace Lutheran Church in Racine, Wisconsin. Come receive God's gifts with us. Find out more about us at gracelutheranracine, that's all one word, .net. And like you, we're proud supporters of Issues Etc.
melody like that just stays with you. You hear it once, and then it's permanently in your mind. And the text along with it, a beautiful hymn from the St. Olaf Kantorei with that hymn, "The Day You Gavest, Lord, Is Ended." It's playing right now at LutheranPublicRadio.org. That's a great example of what you'll hear there 24/7. At our sacred music station, Sacred Music for the World, LutheranPublicRadio.org. And remember to listen Sunday afternoon at 1 and Sunday evening at 8 Central for our weekly Bach cantata fitting for the Sunday at LutheranPublicRadio.org. We're talking about Joshua on this Friday afternoon, August the 30th. Dr. Andrew Steinman is our guest. Dr. Steinman, before the break, we kind of got through the military campaign in Joshua's book. And then in chapter 12, there's something of a roll call. And the land is actually allotted to each of the tribes and to some individuals. Does God intend them to stop there? Because some of the land is left unconquered.
Yeah, well, he doesn't intend them to stop. Their task is to divide up the land. Now that kind of Joshua has broken the back of the resistance, he's conquered several of the major cities, Jericho, Hazor, and so forth, and made it clear, you know, that God will give victory to Israel. They simply need to be faithful to him, and he will bless them with victory. And so what Joshua does is carries out the command of Moses to allot various parts of the land to various tribes, and within those tribes to various clans. And the idea was then that instead of the entire nation now fighting against the Canaanites, they were to split up into tribes, and each tribe was to continue the conquest on their own. And this works a little bit. I mean, we read some of this in the book of Judges, which follows Joshua, where there are a few victories. For instance, the people of Judah go up and with the people of Benjamin conquer Jerusalem and so forth. But for the most part, the problem is that Israel simply settles down in the land, and we know the story from the book of Judges. They begin to adopt Canaanite ways and abandon God. And in fact, this is a major concern of the last chapters of Judges, that Joshua is concerned that this is precisely what Israel is going to do after he dies.
There are several incidents in the course of Joshua's time in the land with the people, wherein he sets up an altar or he kind of parks the tabernacle and the Ark of the Covenant in a certain place. The first place he makes sacrifice, if I'm not mistaken, is Mount Ebal. And it's at pains to talk about there about how he did it precisely as Moses commanded everyone to do before they entered the land. But there's the sacrifice being set up there. And then later it seems to be that Shiloh is the locus of the tabernacle and the worship for the people. Is this kind of all temporary until we get a final resting place some hundred of years later for the Ark of the Covenant?
Yeah, it is kind of a temporary thing. God, you know, commanded through Moses, as you said, that they do this sacrifice and other ceremonies on Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim, which is right next door. Then God has said, you know, you will come to wherever I choose. So wherever God chooses the tabernacle to be in, for a while it's at Shiloh. Later on it will move to several other places. And God makes it clear when finally he gives permission for the temple to be built, gives David permission to prepare the temple to be built by Solomon, that he has chosen Zion. And we see this in several of the Psalms, which talk about how God has chosen Zion. So God, until then, has just decided on these temporary places. And in fact, even when David, you know, kind of springs his plan on Nathan, the prophet, and says, I want to build a temple for God. And when Nathan comes back the next day with God's response, God starts out with, did I ask for a temple? Haven't I lived in a tent ever since we came out of Egypt and ever since we've been in the land? You know, so God makes it clear that he's chosen the place for the tabernacle to be. It's not always stated in so many terms that way when we find all the tabernacles now at Shiloh, or and now it's at this other city or this other city. But God makes it clear to David that, you know, oh, I chose those places, temporary though they may be, you know. And then God makes it clear that he's chosen Zion. It wasn't David's choice. It was God's choice, ultimately, that he should dwell in Zion in the temple there.
The last several chapters of the book of Joshua deal with Joshua nearing his death, renewing the covenant. The most famous words, obviously, choose this day whom you shall serve. And it kind of makes it sound like he's saying, you know, you've got these gods and you've got the true God, kind of make up your mind. But the rest of the history of the people of Israel from this point on is going to rotate, orbit exactly that point, isn't it?
Yeah, this sets up pretty much what is true through the rest of the history books up to the Babylonian captivity. And it's interesting here, you know, that Joshua kind of starts out with a kind of review of their history. You know, that your fathers lived beyond the Euphrates, and God called Abraham from serving other gods, and brought him to Canaan and gave him this promise, and then you went down to Egypt, and, you know, the whole history up to his time. And to rehearse what, you know, that God has never left you. This is what he's done for you. Look at your history and then determine, is that the God you want to serve, the God who has been absolutely faithful to his promises over hundreds and hundreds of years? And Joshua says, that's the God I'm going to serve, and I'm pledging me and my family to serve him. Of course, Israel says, we will too. But it's interesting that Joshua replies, this is in verse 19 of chapter 24, after they say, yeah, we'll serve this God too, Joshua replies, but you're not able to do it. Joshua knows that, you know, sin dwells in the human heart. Israel is no exception. And that he says, you are not able to do it, and if you forsake God then and turn to these foreign gods, then he'll take you out of the land, you'll lose everything that you've gained. But the people insist that they will serve God. And it's interesting that at the end of the book here, we're told that Israel did keep their pledge as long as Joshua was alive. Now, we're not told exactly how long it was after this that Joshua died, but for the remainder of his life, whatever it was, they served the Lord, they worshiped him, they were faithful to their promise. But when we turn the page and go to the book of Judges, we find out once Joshua's dead, that's not the case.
What are your final thoughts on Joshua for our listeners today as the church remembers this Old Testament, a man, the servant of Moses, this judge, this military leader? What are your final thoughts here with about a minute, Dr. Steinman?
Well, one of my thoughts are that, you know, it has to do with Christians as leaders. God calls some Christians to be leaders of his people. And in Joshua, I think we see something close to the ideal leader. He's a sinner. He's not, you know, he's not completely the ideal leader, but something close to it in that he understands that military accomplishments are fine and good, but the real challenge is to remain faithful to God, that we don't allow our old sinful Adam to kick up and separate us from God. And Joshua, as a leader, is, you know, at the very end of his life, makes this point so clear. And I think that in itself shows us also his humility as a leader, that he doesn't say, look what I accomplished, but he goes back over this history on, look what God accomplished. And you know, so that makes him a fairly good example of what Christian leaders should be like. And I think when we're called to positions of leadership among God's people, whether it's, you know, leadership in our family, leadership in our church, wherever God might call us to leadership among the baptized and redeemed people of God, we need to follow examples of godly men like Joshua.
Dr. Andrew Steinman is Distinguished Professor of Theology and Hebrew at Concordia University, Chicago, author of the book From Abraham to Paul, A Biblical Chronology. You can find out more about this book, From Abraham to Paul, and Dr. Steinman's Bible commentaries. They are many. Under the Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org. Dr. Steinman, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome, Todd.
We still have 2 hours of Issues Etc. straight ahead. On the other side of the break, Scott Klusendorf, president of Life Training Institute, joins us. We're going to be responding to some statements on abortion made by a recent guest on the program, Dr. P.Z. Myers, author of The Happy Atheist, dealing with who is the unborn and how does someone arrive at an intrinsic value, if there is such a thing, intrinsic value of human life. We'll respond to all of that with Scott Klusendorf. Then Chris Roseborough joins us. There have been some recent statements made in a sermon on grace by Brian Houston, who is a megachurch pastor of Hillsong Church based in Australia. It's truly a global church that has made some headlines. Chris Roseborough will join us to sort out what it is Brian Houston is saying about homosexuality and grace. Then Dr. Mike Middendorf joins us in about an hour from now, part 6 of our Bible study on the book of Romans. We're going through Romans chapter by chapter. We'll be in chapters 7 and 8 when we come back. We'll be talking about sin and death and the life of the Spirit. That's 1 hour from now, part 6 of our series on the book of Romans with Dr. Mike Middendorf. I'm Todd Wilkin. 2 more hours of Live Issues, Etc. straight ahead.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Logia, a journal of Lutheran theology, presents a new book of essays in honor of Daniel Preuss. It's titled Proper Christum, Christ at the Center. This new hardcover book will be out in November and features essays from Issues Etc. regular guests, Matt Harrison, Scott Murray, David Scare, and others. You can save $10 by advance ordering in August or $5 by pre-ordering in September. Check out Proper Christum, Christ at the Center at shop.logia.org.
This is a message for members of Thrivent Financial for Lutherans. If you designate your Thrivent Choice dollars to Issues Etc. online before October 31st, Thrivent will designate an additional $25 to Issues Etc. For more information on how you can designate funds to Lutheran Public Radio and give an additional $25 to LPR, look for the Thrivent logo under the Donate page at issuesetc.org.